today we're here with Thor Muller, who is co-founder of Get Satisfaction and generally a smart guy out in Silicon Valley. Thor, thanks for joining us, and tell us a little bit about yourself.
Thanks for having me. Wow, that's a wide open question. Where to start? Well, I've been doing this internet entrepreneur thing since the mid-90s, largely by necessity, since I've tended to be a little bit ahead of the market. So not always, but, and this is not a good thing. A lot of times people think that being ahead of the market is such a wonderful thing. But all the people I know who've gotten richest have been a little behind the market.
Yes. The pioneers are the ones with the arrows in their backs.
Yeah, exactly. So lots of scars, lots of friends, but not as rich as many people I know here in the Valley. So,
not
but,
yet.
Yeah. So, let's see. My first business was early web development business, and I started it because nobody would hire me to do their be their webmaster, because nobody knew what the web was. This is, you know, 95 or so. And then I proceeded from there to sell that business and start a software business, internet software, in 99, and rode that roller coaster, the great bubble of 2000, and learned what it meant to sell your soul to the devil, which I wouldn't recommend, but is certainly an appealing option for many these days.
What do you mean by selling your soul to the devil?
I mean, saying what other people want to hear, doing what other people want to buy, well, what VCs want to buy, as opposed to what you believe is actually a useful, meaningful product that has long-term legs. And so, in that particular case, had an idea, which was that the future of the web wasn't going to be simply about building websites, but about distributing content, and that this was going to enable you know, smaller vendors, smaller merchants, smaller content producers to reach much larger audiences. I think the pattern has clearly been proven correct. The question was, what does that mean? And what I started hearing from VCs, me and my partner, when we went out to pitch that, was that the only way to make money with software business was enterprise sales. And so because we wanted to raise the money to build the product, we became an enterprise company. And
you have to listen to VCs because they have this amazing pattern matching ability, right? This
special
thing.
Pattern matching, a phrase, if I never hear it again, will be too soon.
What about at the end of the day?
What happened at the end of the day with this business?
No, at the end of the day, that's another phrase from the VC world.
Oh, at the end of the day, right. Exactly. No, it's just funny how there's a meme vector in the VC world that is so efficient when it comes to language. And, by the way, clothing. But that's another story. I have a lot of friends who are in venture capitalists, and they're not all the same. And there's a lot of great people. Having said that,
at the end of the day, how is their pattern matching? Sorry, go on.
No, it's all right. So we built something which we really didn't care about, and you know, we did it because we felt like it was necessary to get. It's very much like politics, right? Where people want to do good, and on the way to doing good, they end up completely corrupting the things they're doing in order to get the power to do good. And so we have the system we've got. The good thing about Silicon Valley is that it is pretty good at disrupting itself. And so the sort of Sand Hill Road dominant approach of bootstrapping a business, or, you know, iterating an early business, has given way over the years to one which is much more entrepreneurial friendly and much more, in some ways, more open to radical new approaches. It may be less risk oriented when it comes to really big ideas, because they're dealing with much smaller, you know, startup capital. But it's, you know, because it's small amounts, you know, people are willing to say, well, I don't know what this market is, but let's try it. Anyway, went up and down the roller coaster in the early 2000s, and long story short, rediscovered my love of the internet, why I had originally fallen in love with it in the mid-2000s with the rise of Web 2.0, And Chris sort of gets satisfaction because we thought that these sort of Web 2.0 patterns had really great utility within businesses to solve these intractable business problems like customer service, right? Everybody hated customer service. Companies hated it. It was a cost center. And they automated it and drove their customers crazy.
Well, in any kind of direct response, you don't talk to customers. Customers, you run traffic and you test things and you see what people do, and then you pay other people, and they're called customer service, and they're the people that talk to your customers, but otherwise you don't have any interactions with them.
Right, yeah. It seemed to us back then that it was crazy that, you know, marketers would spend millions and millions of dollars to engage with people, right, with whether they were prospects or customers. But meanwhile, when customers were at their most naturally engaged, when they had an issue or they had an idea, they wanted to talk to somebody, the companies essentially built these walls in front of their businesses. So we built Get Satisfaction as a way to sort of tear down those walls and bring people and companies closer together. And it's since become this well-established category of social business, and lots of companies have tackled it. But I feel like, you know, we were definitely pioneers in that space, and Get Satisfaction is continuing to go strong today under leadership of people that like Wendy Lee, who I hired to replace myself as CEO. And so I've since moved on, and along with my co-founder Lane Becker, Get Satisfaction co-founder Lane Becker, who himself had also founded Adaptive Path, an early user experience company. Probably most famous for having coined the term Ajax and the blog way back in the day. We were starting a new business called Original, which we're in the very early stages of creating.
Well, let's talk about that like towards the end.
Sure.
And I want to talk about Get Satisfaction if we can.
Let's do it.
So what do you think of the rip-off report?
Oh, the rip-off... refresh my memory about the report.
Ripoff Report is a site where people can go on and complain about people. So let's say someone didn't like you, they can go and write a complaint about you. And like one of the things that some people did, I noticed a year or so ago, that some people went into the Ripoff Report and put that Sergey Brin was a child molester, and so that then started to rank in searches for Sergey Brin. It's obviously made up, but that was sort of showing the dynamic and the relationship between the Ripoff Report and Google search results and the in a kind of a complex way. And there's a lot of sites doing this. You know, there's scam.com, and you know, there's a bunch of sites that are effectively allow consumers to speak up. And yours was, I guess, a nicer version of those. I would see that. Do you disagree with that?
Well, there was certainly a strong element of that. But let me go back a little bit. The idea of Get Satisfaction started with the idea simply that customers wanted a more open conversational approach to dealing with companies, right? That blogs and social networks were sort of a natural fit for the customer service needs. And so our first version of the product, the one we went out and pitched originally, was essentially just a community, a customer support community app for businesses with a 37 signal style sales model.
Mm.
And it's sort of similar to what we ended up doing, actually, in the long run. But what we realized was that we were doing this at a time where people had lots of complaints and no good place to put them. Twitter had not emerged yet as a mainstream phenomenon. Facebook was still just for colleges, and so we said, you know what? Let's launch not as a software as a service, but instead let's launch as an open customer service community where anybody who had an issue can post it about any company, and essentially pull the company into the conversation. And that was our distribution model. It was this kind of jiu-jitsu move about giving power to individuals.
Is it just companies? Like, can I go on and say I want Get Satisfaction with Thor and like start a whole page about you and that sort of thing? Like, how does that sort of process work?
Well, originally we thought that might happen, but because of we designed it around companies, it really didn't happen. Really, it was people asking questions, reporting problems, sharing ideas around companies. And so sometimes these would be very positive in nature, like, let's say Timbuktu, the bag manufacturer. I mean, people would go on there and they would brainstorm about how to improve the products and rave about new designs that had come out. And sometimes they'd be very negative, like Comcast, which...
that's basically any conversation about Comcast, though, right?
Well, largely, although I will say that Comcast at that moment was doing some innovative things about... They had this little skunkworks team that was focused on just responding to people on blogs and social networks. And so they were very responsive, incredibly responsive. But it was challenging because they had very little direct control or power over the infrastructure that people were dealing with or the technology they were dealing with. But they were able to put a human face on the company. So it was really interesting. It was the very early stages of what became sort of social media revolution. And Comcast was, they were very pioneering there. But you can't easily overcome the scale of the infrastructure problem that they are dealing with. And so later on, we met with Virgin, who is famous for their great customer service. And they had just bought England's largest cable company. And, well, they were used to, incredibly high customer service scores. With this, even after a year or two of running this cable company, they were still dealing with abysmal customer service ratings with their cable company because it's so hard. I mean, it really is. The category of infrastructure is just its own category when it comes to the scale of that problem. But anyway, we gained a lot by this kind of empowering of the customer to be in charge of this conversation. And, it certainly worked for us. We created a lot of SEO content, and it put us on the map. But it was also limiting, right? We realized that it was easy for people to sort of hijack, a few squeaky wheels to hijack the conversation. And so there was the promise of what we were talking about, a more transparent, human-oriented business experience or customer experience. And then there was the reality, which is that there's sort of asymmetric power for not just individuals, but certain individuals with a lot more time on their hand and a lot more, let's say, anger or maybe sociopathology. So we had to start, a lot of the business design at that point was, how do we keep the spirit of what we were about, again, empowering individuals, in order to make better businesses in the long run, but how do we do that in a way which wasn't so easily hijackable by the squeaky wheels? And that, I think, is, in a nutshell, the path that Get Satisfaction has been on for a long time. How do you balance those two sides?
And so, how do you do it?
Well, you do it in a couple of ways. One is you find ways where the collective can monitor itself, right? So, many people can easily recognize when a few people are undermining them. And again, easier said than done, because though many people may recognize it, getting many people to take action is hard, especially when they have much less innate motivation a lot of times. Now, maybe if they're in a theater and they're all trying to watch the movie, they'll shout down the one annoying guy. But when it comes to an internet community, it's easy for people to just go somewhere else.
Yeah, I mean, you don't really build. Do you have a community? Like, are there people that are like, this is great, I'm like helping patrol the Get Satisfaction forums?
Yeah. So one of the things we did was we created this idea of champions. And so, one of the classic ways you enable people to take more responsibility for sort of social mores within a space, is you give them a little bit of power, right? And sometimes that's just simply as a badge. It's a hall monitor concept, right? And you give somebody a clipboard and a little badge, and all of a sudden they feel like, you know, they've been deputized with power, even though it's just a badge and a clipboard. So there was that, and that helped. And ultimately we allowed organizations to deputize people within their own communities. The second thing area that you really focus on is is empowering organizations or people within organizations. They have far more persistent interest in managing a healthy environment than any other individuals. So we did that. We rolled out our paid plans, which came attached with moderation tools. That was a hard shift, though, right? Because if you're about empowering people, the customers, and doing it on creating a level playing field with the company, but then you're giving companies more and more abilities to control what individuals can do. At first, it seems like you're kind of abandoning your principles, and that was a hard shift for the company to make, because we were pretty value. We created the company to be very values based, and so a lot of some of the employees were saying, if we allow companies to delete posts by customers, then we're essentially allowing censorship, and there's no transparency to that. And why are we even doing this? So we had to think through those problems and come up with solutions. So our solution to that one was to create a change log, so that a company could delete those posts, but that fact that they'd made this deletion would be available for others to see. And while most customers never go to the change log, the fact that it exists, it establishes a kind of statement of commitment to the ideal. And so that's the kind of design, product design that we did. And it's not about one feature at any given time. It's about the system and what the system adds up to.
So I think in this category, like Ripoff Report is one of the most interesting, and I'm really interested to interview that guy sometime. It seems like their business model is collect lots of complaints, and then people can apply to their Be a Better Business program, and you can pay quite a lot of money and then get the complaints removed. And I've had people tell me that they've gone ahead and done that. I think it will depend on the seriousness of the complaints, but I've heard numbers of something like $250,000 to have a whole lot of bad complaints removed, and then, be suddenly a reformed business and good corporate citizen going forward. What are your thoughts on that sort of stuff?
I'm not a fan of hijacking companies. And I think that collecting complaints with the business model of allowing companies to remove those complaints if they pay enough, I mean, it's kind of a nasty business. And I think that Yelp at one point was accused of doing something kind of similar. I just don't think that's a business that I'd want to personally be associated with. I don't know if that's exactly characterizing what they're doing right, but I know a Consumer Reports style business, which is more crowd based, I think is an awesome idea. So if that's what they're doing, then all the better. I think that what gets lost a lot of times is the context. If somebody has a bad experience, I'll give you an example. Last night I was at a diner, which downtown San Francisco. It turned out that it was the busiest night this place maybe ever had, because they were doing a lighting of the bridge, of this new Bay Bridge span, for the first time. And so there was tens of thousands of people down there in a line around the block just to get a hamburger. And so we ordered a hamburger, and they lost their order, and it ended up taking us an hour to get our hamburger. And so it would be very easy to go online on Yelp and say, it took me an hour to get my hamburger, and they lost my order. But that completely missed the context, that this was a an abnormal situation, and they were doing their best, and they were extremely apologetic, and they gave my son an ice cream cone to make up for it. I could have left all that out and just focused on the negative. And that kind of thing happens all the time when we're talking about our feelings about products and services. And so I think that there are other factors that come in, such as the reputation or the, you know, the big long-term behavior of a person who's making a complaint. So I think that as we, you know, we're entering in a new stage of the internet where we can actually start to uncover deeper truths about the opinions that are shared. It's not just the opinion itself is the tip of the iceberg. Who is making that opinion? What is their MO in life? You know, who, what other kinds of people trust them, and so forth and so on. I would like to see our systems get much smarter so that they're not so easily ripped, you know, we're not ripped off by, you know, what seem like smart systems that aren't.
So what do you think about the relationship then between Google and sites like Get Satisfaction and Rip Off Report and all of the others? Because to me this is a really interesting balance, and I've chatted with Matt Cutts about it a bit. I'm interested in your thoughts.
Yeah, the work that Matt Cutts and his company do over there is really admirable. I mean, it's a massive scale battle of good and evil, in a sense. There was a situation 2 years ago where this guy who sold sunglasses online bragged to the New York Times that...
Yes.
Yeah. That
go on,
he,
go on.
Yeah, he cultivated bad reviews because they actually improved his SEO, right? And he mentioned Get Satisfaction as one place where he had cultivated bad reviews because lots of people went to Get Satisfaction and complained about fraud, I mean, literally fraud. And here he was bragging that this was a good thing for him. Well, as you can imagine, this was not something that we wanted, that we thought was true or a good idea. And Google was in the same boat. And so, you know, Google, I blogged about it at the time, and as did Matt Cutts. And, you know, what Matt, you know, did is, what they did is announce, you know, improved algorithms to ensure that this didn't happen, and you know, a lot of this has to do with how Google, you know, Google ranks these types of things. But I do think that because most visits to these kinds of sites, whether it's Get Satisfaction or Rip Off Report or others, go through Google. Google is in the unenviable position of having to, if they're going to live up to their mission, they have to add a layer of intelligence, right? They have to they have to know sentiment, and they have to take that into account, and they have to understand reputation, which they already do to some extent. Like, that's part of PageRank, is understanding reputation in a context of an interest domain. So, I think that Google is part of the solution, and other search engines.
But Google assigns quite a lot of weight to sites like Rip Off Report and, you know, Get Satisfaction and all of these others. I mean,
yeah.
In any business area, there's the good part of town and then there's the bad part of town, and you guys are obviously in the good part of town. But, you know, how does Google decide this weight, and is it always fair? Because I see stuff out there that to me is patently unfair. And I mean, you're on, you know, the hard side of reputation management. I mean, you know, someone does something stupid sometime in business or in school or whatever, and it gets complained about, and then for then on, it's on search for their name, and that's insane.
Yeah, and I think that when we talk about the, you know, all the benefits of the, you know, of the internet or of social media or of transparency in general, we have to be very brutally honest that there's a recognizable downside. I understand that, you know, where Google's coming from. I mean, they're a business that makes its money through pay-per-click advertising, and that, you know, a huge portion of that comes from e-commerce companies and other service providers. And so there's a kind of editorial advertising bright line, and so with their algorithms, you know, I think that they want to show the good, the bad, and the ugly for people alongside the ads, which might be, you know, very slanted towards
you know, the companies, there's a certain logic there, and it's very difficult for them to know the difference between an exposé of a bad product and a squeaky wheel. On the one hand, there are the responsibilities of these systems, whether it's get satisfaction with its sort of social design and tools for moderating, healthy and honest communities. There's the system design of Google, who has to figure out what to present for a given search. But there's also culture. There's also the way that individuals and companies change over time. So, 15 years ago, the MO for a company was, if something bad happened, to go into a classic PR damage control mode, right? To reframe, to point the finger elsewhere, to have the lawyers review every bit of language and so forth and so on. Today, for more and more companies, I don't know if we're quite at the point where we can call it the norm, but it's much more common for an individual talking in human language to come out very quickly and say, hey, we're hearing this issue, it's a real issue, and either, we feel terrible about this and we're working on fixing it, or, we're trying to figure out what's going on, send us information. It's much more human, realistic.
I know, but it's like the celebrities who have a problem and then they're like, yeah, and so, I'm really sorry, and now I'm going into rehab. Maybe it's just the new fashion way to handle the same thing.
Yeah, it's an interesting challenge, right? Because when honesty becomes commoditized, once upon a time, being honest was being honest. And now what you're saying, which is there's some truth to it, is honesty can be just an artifice. And so the question is, is it better to have honesty as an artifice than to not have honesty at all? or is there a way to just differentiate between sort of shallow honesty and deep honesty? These are deep questions, and I don't have the answers to them. I do think that we're entering a point in our society where we're asking these questions more and more. I think, to me, I take a long view. I think about a kind of small town, small community, point, let's say 19th century Americana, right? Europe, other places where most people knew each other in a town, and you opened the store, and the store owner knew everybody. And so reputation and business was just naturally tightly intertwined. And then in the 20th century, era of modernism, we scaled everything. It was all about scale, right? How do we give education to, universal education to everybody that's of universal quality? How do we make appliances that everybody can have access to, right? We had cars in every driveway, et cetera, right? And so there were all kinds of trade-offs that happened as a result of that. And one of which was we cut a very sharp line between personal reputation and professional reputation. And so you could justify doing things in your profession that were, you would have thought were immoral in a small town because they were, they were cruel, right? Whether that was...
It's not personal, it's just business.
It's not personal, it's just business. Yeah, exactly. And so, hopefully we're, one of the benefits is that we're moving to a world where, personal and professional reputations are much more intertwined, and as a result, we're much more accountable to our behaviors in the marketplace. Now, there's evidence on both sides on this one, but I hope that we keep working towards that accountability, because I don't think that the Earth can take a tremendous amount more of not thinking about the long-term implications of what we're doing, especially when it comes to our footprint in the natural world.
Was what you were doing with Get Satisfaction, was this a fun business that you're not running the business anymore, but was it a fun business to work on? Because for me, it's the kind of thing that I would think about and naively start and say, this is going to be really interesting, and then a year or two later start to be like, oh my god, what the hell have I gotten myself into, because you're dealing with such intensity of problems.
Well, I think many businesses are ones where year two and you say, what the hell have I gotten myself into? You know, if you get deep into a problem, you get into the tough, nasty stuff. So what was exciting about Get Satisfaction was approaching this sort of rewiring of this relationship between companies and customers. It was that culture, reimagining that culture, that relationship. And so it was fun for as long as, for as long as that was the primary thing we were doing. Fun for me. Now, as we began to get more into scaling up a software as a service business, there are certain people for whom that is fun, and that was less fun for me. And it's less to do with the business model of software as a service, and it had more to do with the level of problem solving, the kind of problem solving. God knows that it requires an ongoing effort of monitoring what's happening behaviorally in a community, and then adjusting and adapting and redesigning. That's an ongoing challenge. But I will say that there's a big difference between going into an open space that's really undefined, it's kind of abstract, and figuring out what the natural grain of the problem is and building solutions that are scalable and so on.
Aristotle talks about breaking problems down to the first principles. I've gotten really interested in philosophy, and that sounds like what you're describing.
Exactly. And I thrive in those kinds of environments, right? So I'm naturally comfortable in undefined problem spaces. And that's what Get Satisfaction was for the first, not just for 1 or 2 years, but probably 3 or 4 years. The fact that so many people have ripped off, I shouldn't say that in a bad way. They've stolen, in the sort of Picasso sense, many of the ideas that we, I think, innovated with Get Satisfaction. I can give you examples, but that suggests to me that we were able to have some success in breaking things down into first principles. But then after that, it gets into a sort of incremental turning of the crank in the business. And it doesn't have to. I mean, obviously, great businesses reinvent themselves. They find new problem areas to explore, and I'm sure Get Satisfaction will do that. But I found myself less interested in the space the more it became a known and sort of quantified problem area.
What were the categories that had the most complaints?
Categories in terms of companies or of.
Yeah, like what's it, you mentioned, I've just always assumed that Comcast and Time Warner are bad companies. Like I have, here in New York, I have a little unknown company called RCN, and I get a bill every month for $34 or something, and I get my 20 megabits per second download, and I'm delighted. Because when I was living in the Caribbean, I was paying something like $200 a month, and it would go down pretty frequently, whereas this almost never goes down. So I love my little cable company that no one's heard of. And I don't understand, what's going on with Comcast and all these others that they do generate so much complaints, and that my guess is that there are categories. Is there a problem with those companies, or, you felt it's the category? Are there certain categories that generate more complaints, like cable?
Yeah, so little breakdown I'd made several years ago in a presentation was that there are sort of three kinds of companies in relation to customer service. One are product-driven companies, like an Apple, right, which they aim for delight in the product, and they try to embed as much of the sort of customer service needs into the product itself. Second would be sort of customer-driven companies, and here I'd give Zappos as the quintessential example. They've made it a kind of explicit manifesto that customers are the center of their business. And, hotels, great hotels are like this, right? And great restaurants are like this. It's all about the customer. And actually what they are building or what they're selling can often be really secondary to just the way they go about serving customers. Nordstrom's, the department store, famous for this. You can return items to Nordstrom's, even if you hadn't bought them there. That's how far to take that idea, right?
Mm.
And then you've got infrastructure type companies, right, which are providing sort of the guts, the plumbing for our modern life to exist on. And so they're, each of those are a little bit, they have different relationships to their customers. Now, what's interesting is that you can, these are not like written in stone, they're just more like archetypes. So you can take take one type and turn it into another. So, for instance, although there may be some constraints on it, so you take internet service, right? You could take a product-centric approach to an infrastructure, what historically has been an infrastructure category, and deliver some of the experiential benefits of, you know, being like a product-oriented business. You would force you to approach the problem differently. Also, it tends, those types of approaches tend to, well, let's take this cable company you're talking about. I'd assume they're not laying fiber all around the world. They're probably sitting on top of somebody else's fiber, and so they don't have a control at the sort of lowest level, like a Comcast would, for instance. But what they get is the ability to innovate on top of that, and so it's that kind of.
Well, I mean, I'm not getting any innovation from my cable company. They offer, you know, email accounts, and I'm sure they offer other services. I don't even actually really know what they offer, because as soon as it got plugged in, like, I had my internet, and because I run everything on top of that as a separate layer. So I don't actually know what my cable company offers. I just know that the service is generally fast and it stays up. But I mean, so I, back to my question: what categories do you notice more complaints in general?
Well, bigger companies. You know, the biggest companies, people have a lot less patience for, right? So they're little business, people are more likely to treat them like other people. But if they're a big corporation, people are assuming that you're going to screw them, right? So it's a defensive crouch versus, you know, an open engagement, perspective. And that shows up in absolutely all of the data, right? So, you know, smaller companies are more likely to get idea suggestions, right? Whereas bigger companies are more likely to see lots of problems. So in Good Satisfaction, we break up the posts by, you know, questions, problems, ideas, and praise. And so you can actually, you know, measure these distinctions on that basis. So a lot of companies will you know, they'll have campaigns to get people to make suggestions about a new product, or conversely, they'll make it a goal as they release a new product or a new release of an existing product to, you know, reduce or minimize the number of problems that are posted. It's almost like, you know, a kind of external measure of bugs. So, yeah, at a high level, it's a scale issue. In terms of, you know, specific categories, complex products are always a challenge. Right. They're going to generate more problems, more confusion, and more frustration by end users.
So can you give me some specifics?
Well, by the way, I think this is one of the reasons why cable companies and telecom companies do have such a high, and computer companies, technology companies in general, have high frustration rates. And companies like Apple, one of the reasons why they've historically had really high customer service ratings is because they've, you know, focused so much on simplicity, on reducing, if not features, at least the features you have to deal with when you take it out of the box.
Hmm.
But in terms of other examples...
No, I mean, that makes sense. That's more clear now, and I get where you're going with it. Tell us a little bit about your next business. It's called Original.
Right. So Original, so early in the process that I don't even have a final elevator pitch, but I will say that it's about, you know, the sort of short description is that we're going to make a place for people to demonstrate, discover, and develop professional skills. And the high level, you know, framing is that we believe that work is changing. That the things that have traditionally mattered, like going to the right schools, staying in positions and companies for, you know, periods, and that being the primary way in which that you're measured, in many cases the only way in which you're measured in terms of your career, is no longer the best, is no longer the default for more and more people. I mean, it still exists. I mean, certainly resumes still matter. You know, LinkedIn is still, like, you know, is an incredibly useful tool for sort of screening people. But increasingly, what you do, you know, the work that you do, the projects that you work on, is more and more important. And careers are made are more unpredictable. New technologies come along, new roles come along, industries are destroyed and created. And so it's never been more important for people to be empowered to manage their own trajectory, right? So while there are more ways to learn skills in terms of, you know, e-learning, what are the right skills to identify, to work on, to develop? So at a high level, that's kind of what we're... But
will this be a site for hiring, or is it for learning skills, or like what kind of direction will it go in?
Right now we're focused on individuals, on giving them the ability to represent themselves and their work and commingle with others that are either on similar paths or on, you know, paths that would matter to them. And then making this available to organizations. In terms of, I mean, it has an impact on hiring. We think that, when we talk to people who do a lot of hiring, they're using tools like GitHub more to accelerate their hiring process, right? For developers, they're hiring a developer to be able to see the code that somebody has worked on, really, really valuable. And so what are other ways that, you know, this pattern can take shape? So we're looking at that kind of thing. You know, other tools that people use in the space are like Behance, which Adobe just bought, for designers to present their creative work. So we think this space is getting shaken up. It's very early, and there are very, very little settled. I mean, we have basically one dominant app in this area, and that's LinkedIn. And meanwhile, the space is, you know, changing at an accelerating rate. So we're excited about it.
I did a startup weekend this past weekend and joined a team of one guy, and what he wanted to do was to test people for hiring for jobs, because he was saying exactly what you're saying, that hiring is skills or credentials are basically becoming irrelevant, and it's more about what you can do. And
right.
he said that he wanted to test people to build a process for doing that. And I was like, well, that's actually what I do when I hire people, is I test them and I get much better people. And
yeah.
And so I joined his team and we came in third place. And we actually may well have won it, except that it was focused around education and we were kind of there about making money. So it sounds like you're heading into that same area, and that maybe that's an area that's taking off.
Yeah, I think there's really interesting things happening in the space. I mean, right now I'm playing around with Coursera, for instance, and I'm, you know, one of the things we're looking at is, you know, how we can leverage, you know, graph visualizations and stuff like that. And there's an amazing course on Coursera taught by a University of Michigan professor who spent, you know, a year inside Facebook, and she's teaching this class on, you know, graph analysis, graph visualization. And so if you're directed, there has never been more information out there. And the question is, how can we, you know, help people feel not so overwhelmed, right? There may be more information out there, but that's really harder for people to deal with. So, you know, it's kind of like what we were talking about with technology products that lead to, you know, the more complex they are, the more they lead to customer service challenges, right? More frustration from customers. I think that this is a general phenomenon for people. There are more tools, and yet they've never been happier. Or, to quote Louis C.K., everything is amazing and nobody's happy.
Hmm.
So how do we bridge that gap? How do we make this explosion of information meaningful for people on a human scale? And so, yeah, it's an exciting time.
So on an unrelated but interesting to me topic, Tell me about what you think about science funding.
Right.
We've just as a backstory, I've been arguing with Thor about this on Twitter, and we had about 50 tweets each pummeling each other on this topic. So I'm interested to hear your thoughts verbally.
Right. So the reason why I took a strong stand on this is because I have a good friend who is the head of research at a cancer lab, and he's been telling me for some time now about how the landscape has changed for long-term cancer research, and about how his job, which used to be 15% of his time going out and finding grants to fund his lab, is now over 50%, and that there's less grants and less. It's bearing less fruit, even though spending so much more time, and that, which is one thing, but the impact is felt with his ability to hire, and other people like him, ability to hire young researchers who would then go be on a track to have their own long-term research and have groundbreaking research and so forth, and that essentially that demand, loss in demand by these research labs being taken up by commercial entities, biotech, pharma, and so on. And while those companies work on important things, they often rely on historically have relied on the public long-term research. So he was really concerned by that, and it made a lot of sense to me. So when we talk about cutting NIH budget by 5%, it's the impact that represents is potentially much greater than it appears on the face of it.
And so my response is that in two areas, which you helped me clarify on Twitter, is that I believe science funding should be focusing on two things, that we should be doing the mega projects like the genome project, and then they've just announced this brain mapping project, and these are things that are important and good and require billions of dollars and just scientists need to plow away and get those done. And then I think we should be focusing on serendipity, and because it's something, as I've looked into a bit more, and I'm going to be talking to more people on this topic, that the big breakthroughs, you see all these big Nobel Prize winners that are these hotshots, and they don't often talk about how they actually figured out what they figured out, but they more often than not just stumbled across things. They stumble on things. These concepts of this brilliant guy who is just brilliant it takes a smart person, but the right place, right time, I think, is actually more important. And now that we have the internet, I think we're able to let people be in the right place and right time more effectively and take advantage of that better. So I would say we should be doing mega projects and then looking for things a little bit like Y Combinator, but for science, so that can take the serendipity ideas that might sound insane and get them channeled into the right direction so that they can be tested and built out.
Right, and I like that overall. I think that it's kind of almost a platonic ideal. I guess where I come in is that I think there's a level of reality which is we have to bridge the gap between the platonic ideal and what we see in the world. So, but let me take your points one by one. First of all, I last year wrote a book, published a book called Get Lucky, which is subtitled How to Put Planned Serendipity to Work for You in Your Business. So I'm a huge believer in what you're saying about serendipity. I'm not even a believer. It's just a fact, and it's a logical fact if you think about it. Any project, any breakthrough has its roots somewhere in an unexpected discovery, right? Because when an individual is starting out in life, they most of what has become they haven't yet discovered. So you don't know where that's going to happen, but you know that it happens. And the question is, what enables serendipity to occur, right? But by the way, some of the best writing on serendipity is in the field of science.
Yes.
There's a great, great book called Chance, Chase, and Creativity by a neurologist, his last name is Austin, and he wrote this book in the late 70s, but it's been reprinted ever since. I discovered it through Mark Andreessen, who wrote a blog post about it. And he basically takes apart what makes for breakthroughs in research, and
he distills it into four kinds of luck, two of which are very clearly serendipity. The fourth may be a variant of it, and the first is really blind luck. And most of the good stuff happens in not blind luck. I mean, there are components that are blind luck, but that's not enough. That's not enough to have breakthrough. You have to be able to recognize novelty, right? You have to be able to put the pieces together. So that's where training comes in, right?
Well, not necessarily, because the big breakthroughs, I mean, if you must have read Structures of Scientific Revolutions, the big breakthroughs come from two places. It's guys who are either new to a field or guys who are very young. And so I think you've got to be a little bit careful on the concept of training, because...
by training, you're right. If I was writing this, I would have replaced that word. I would have seen it as, definitely not training. But knowledge of some sort. You have to have some knowledge, and it doesn't always have to be knowledge that's directly related, but it has to be knowledge of some sort to map to it in a novel way. But you're right that oftentimes it's knowledge from another category that intersects with this new observation.
Right.
But it's not always young. I mean, I think that it's having maybe not what do they call it novice's mind or something like this. The point is that you can cultivate a mindset which is like a young person's mind. Right, and that's a huge part of this, right? It's pushing out of your mind what you know to be true, right? Because, and this is really a downside of training, I think, is what you're getting at, which is that training is often telling us all the things that we know to be true. It's filling your head up with facts. But so often the breakthroughs come around things where they actually challenge the facts, right? And I've lots of examples of this.
Well, and I think we have a mutual favorite there, which is Charles Darwin.
The ramifications
of that are still being felt, and I think are going to continue. That's going to continue for a long time.
Yeah, for sure. But I just put a capper on this. I think that the benefit of some of the long term public research projects, beyond aiming for the moonshots, is to create space for people to not have the kind of pressure to perform against a plan. Now they're increasingly, a lot of research projects, particularly in sort of within graduate programs, as it's been funded by commercial entities, this has been undermined. So we may actually be moving further away from this. It would be an interesting study. But the problem within commercial, many but not all commercial organizations, is that if there are findings that don't map to the goals, they're suppressed or put aside, right? Now, the best organizations they've designed themselves to take advantage of these discoveries. And examples would be 3M, which were able to take advantage of the discovery of this weak adhesive, which became the Post-it note. Mm. Another example, it was G.D. Searle, a pharmaceutical company, that one scientist discovered while looking for an ulcer medication, discovered a super sweet substance that became NutraSweet, right? They were actually not only able to recognize this was important, but created a whole new product division of food products to bring it to market, and many others. The point is that it requires conscious design within those organizations to avoid the traps of sticking to plan and focusing with blinders on. I love the idea that Y Combinators can sort of pick up some of that slack. But even with Y Combinator, the problem is you're creating incredible financial pressure and time pressure on somebody, and that's great for startups, but it may not be ideal for basic scientific research.
I don't know. I mean, and we need to wrap up, but just the concept of, in science, of having an MVP, minimum viable product, some of the lean methodologies, and having some initial goals and then testing those, and then if you're able to get either that outcome or some sort of outcome and, have some short hypothesis testings and be moving forward and then be demonstrating validity that way would seem to me to make sense.
Well, it can't. No, so here's the thing. It often can, but it doesn't always, right? There's the famous example of, I'm going to forget the details. It wasn't penicillin. It was a cure for a disease that I can't remember right now, but it took the scientists hundreds of times of repeating an experiment with apparently no progress. And he was just obsessed. And, you know, he had the ability through his tenured position to keep doing it. People thought he was crazy, but he kept going. And finally, he cracked the code. And so some things just require that, right? They just don't fit into that pattern of, you know, of short hops each time making incremental improvements.
And that's what I would suggest has changed because we have the internet and such broad communication that someone somewhere can come up with part of the answer and post it, and then someone can come up with more of it, and it works through the solution. Like I think things are getting different, and I think that can impact science. But
yeah, no, it definitely will. But I think that we should look at the pattern, look at what fits what process, and and change as fast as we can, take advantage of these new processes. But we should just be honest about what doesn't fit. And I think that there are more things that don't fit than that us techno utopians sometimes like to think.
Fair enough. And now you can see why Thor and I were arguing about this on Twitter. Thor, is there anything else you want to add before we wrap up?
That's it. I really enjoyed the conversation. Wish you and your audience the best.